ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to A Big Country. I'm David Claughton, and it's lovely to have your company as we join our reporters exploring regional Australia. This week, we're getting a history lesson into how a summer fruit became a local favourite when we hear the story of how mangoes came to be grown down under. We'll meet a long-time listener to Australia's longest-running radio program as the Country Hour celebrates 8 decades of broadcasting. And we're heading into the classroom to meet the young preschoolers learning about the dairy industry. Their lessons cover everything from tractors and cows to making butter in the hope that it might lead to a career in dairy well into the future.
Some people might think it's really young to be speaking about careers with, you know, 3, 4, 5 year olds, but we know that young people know what career they don't want to do very early. And if we don't introduce them to a range of careers in the dairy industry at this young age, it's likely that they won't consider that when they are getting to their career making decision time in their life.
First today, we start with a remarkable story from far northwestern Australia. In 1967, a girl was standing barefoot on the hot sand of the Great Sandy Desert, amidst the low scrub and spinifex grass, surrounded by her family. Her photograph is taken, and her life changes forever. Boogara Woya and her family were removed from their traditional desert life and taken into a Kimberley mission. Now aged 70, she's never stopped wondering about that photo and never forgotten her connection to her traditional land. Erin Park has the story.
It's wet season in the central Kimberley.
I'm driving about 300 kilometres inland from Broome, trying to get to a small community called Luma, where there's a woman with a very special, unusual life story that, as far as I know, has never been recorded before.
Within minutes of arriving, I'm directed to her house.
My name is Boogara Woya. I come from the bush. I've been coming in 1967.
Boogara grew up in the desert. The Dowling woman is one of only a handful of surviving elders in Australia who remembers life before contact with white people. Now around 70 years old, her life is one of quiet routines, walking daily to the aged care centre.
She's really bossy at times, like most of the time, so yeah. But she's good.
Yeah. I come from Great Sandy Desert. I was born in Whittedin. What a whole called Whittedin. I've been growing up all my life in the bush.
Boogara's ancestors had lived uninterrupted for thousands of years in the vast desert plains.
We walk around everywhere. We collect everything. We should go everywhere. Water all up the water hole.
But the 1960s were a time of great change in northern Australia. Suddenly there were new people moving across the landscape. White people. It was 1967 when Boogara first heard the truck approaching.
Do you remember the first time you saw a white person?
Yeah, I seen him, a white person walking with shirt and trousers. And my sister Shelley, what was it? He went and hid in the bush. And I told my mummy, "Mummy, you look like us, same."
Boogara's just told me something pretty crazy, which is that the moment that her life changed forever was actually captured on camera. Apparently, that moment in the desert when she first saw white people, there was a woman there taking photographs, and she's got an album with the originals here at her house. So we're just going to have a dig around and try to find them.
This is my mum. This is my grandmother. This is my mum.
Should we go outside, have a look?
Just about out.
The single photograph shows her family's first interaction with the white fella world. The missionaries and welfare officers handing them clothes and guiding them into the back of the truck. But Boogara says she used to have a whole set of photos that were taken on that life-changing day, including one showing her posing for the camera. But the photo album cannot be found. Maybe lost, maybe stolen.
I've been looking for the photos, but I couldn't find it. I don't know where he was.
I promised to try to find the photos. They're irreplaceable, showing the moment that two wildly different cultures intersected in that hot desert sand.
So I'm back in Broome and I think I've had a breakthrough after several months of digging. There's a local historian and author who's passed me on this CD. She's had it in her possession for many years. It's got 23 images on it and she reckons one of them is that missing photograph showing Boogera as a child.
Before long, I'm back on the road to Luma. I find Boogera in her usual spot. Hanging out with her best friend and next door neighbour, Polly, who came out of the desert the same year.
It's been 6 months since I came and visited you. You been well?
I've been well, and I look happy.
It's time to show Boogera the photograph.
Is this the photo you were telling me about? How do you feel to see it?
This is me, Boogera. I came with name of Boogera. I had the name because my dad called me name.
The photo was taken as the last of the desert families were moving onto cattle stations and church-run missions along the coast. Some voluntarily, exhausted by drought, others rounded up reluctantly. The photographer was a nurse who was volunteering at the LaGrange Catholic Mission, where Boogera and her family were soon taken.
Oh, they've probably been through a lot of changes.
My mother.
Boogera's cousin is visiting from Perth and seeing the photos for the first time.
For her, a young girl, it would have been confusing. That picture says it all right there, leaving home, you know, and wherever this mob was taking them. It would have been sad at that moment, but it would have been scary.
Boogera went on to marry a man named Jimmy, and they had three children, two of whom have since died. Boogera visits the desert less now. She's getting frail and can no longer drive. But when she closes her eyes, she's back there.
I'm sorry for that country. I've been sorry too. Sad. I've been crying everywhere a whole while because I got the memories in that place.
They've come far, very far, a long way, and they're still here, you know, managing both worlds, I guess.
At this kindergarten in Victoria's South Gippsland region, the next generation of dairy experts and advocates are being nurtured from a young age. Hi there, I'm Faith Tabaluyan and I'm visiting the Lee and Gatha Community Preschool here in one of the state's largest dairy farming regions. It's the first time this preschool has run this Dairy in Kinder program, which aims to teach little learners about farming, sustainability and healthy eating, and it seems they're taking the lessons to heart.
I've learned that the milk gets processed.
How does it get processed?
A big factory.
Big factory. And where does the milk come from in the first place?
The cows.
That's Campbell Wooding from Lee and Gatha. At just 5 years old, he's already an advocate for the local dairy industry.
I was just eating cheese.
Some good cheese?
Yeah.
Campbell is among a handful of Lee and Gatha Community Preschool students participating in a new Dairy in Kinder program, which is running for the next 12 months, funded by a $10,000 grant from the Gardner Foundation. Amy Cosby is a parent and dairy farmer from Lee and Gatha South. She says when it comes to ag education, starting early is key.
Some people might think it's really young to be speaking about careers with, three, four, five-year-olds, but we know that young people know what career they don't want to do very early. And if we don't introduce them to a range of careers in the dairy industry at this young age, it's likely that they won't consider that when they are getting to their career-making decision time in their life. So we'll take kids out on excursions to dairy farms, probably ours, and also we'll bring some calves into the kinders next year during calving to show them how calves are fed, And, you know, perhaps for some of them, even though they live in a dairy region, if you are not connected with a dairy farmer personally through friends or family, you might never have been on a dairy farm, or you might never have interacted with a cow. You might not know anything about them. So by introducing it to young kids like this, they'll go home and tell their families, which is really important. And when they're in the supermarket, they're choosing to buy Australian dairy products.
Ms. Cosby's taken that approach with her own three boys, starting with 5-year-old Oscar and 4-year-old Zave.
Oscar, why do you love being a dairy farmer?
Milk the cows.
What cow do you milk?
My cow.
Zavey, what do you like about being a dairy farmer?
Cows.
What do you like about the cows, though?
Milk.
And what do you like doing in the tractor?
Cutting silage.
Bessa Wooding is the mum of Campbell, our other 5-year-old dairy expert. She and her family moved to Leongatha in 2021, keen to leave city life behind. Despite having no farming background, Ms. Wooding says she's all for more dairy education.
Yeah, really excited. I think it's great for the kids to have this opportunity, especially kids that probably don't get a lot of experience or first-hand time on farms. I think that it's going to be great for the kids to get involved.
Emily Duncan is a local parent who also sits on the Kinder's fundraising committee.
We thought, why not jump on it? We have so many farms around Leongatha. What a perfect opportunity for us to capitalise on that.
Despite not working the land herself, Ms. Duncan says farming is a favourite topic in her family.
I did not grow up on a farm, but I have a close family connection with my in-laws being dairy farmers and my sister and her husband dairy farming close by in Fish Creek as well. We talk a lot about where our food comes from. We talk a lot about Pa's farm. We talk a lot about the farms around town and what they're growing and things like that. A lot of interest comes in the tractors. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter that is really interested in tractors at the moment. And at the moment it's silage season, so there's a lot of interest in the silage, whether we're baling or making a pit silage. So, yeah, a lot of the time we are talking about farms.
So how do you bring the world of dairy into the classroom? Here's teacher Belinda Elliott to explain.
All the basics of where their food comes from and simple things like farm animals. We relate it back to art projects and we incorporate it into even cooking experiences. This year we created our own butter by churning our own cream and cooking with that. We spread it onto some beautiful scones that we'd made, and it was a really good way for children to get a good visual in how things are made in the dairy industry.
And did the kids have a lot of questions about the butter?
Yeah, they did. Well, they were more interested in the taste testing side of things too. They enjoyed the buttermilk, which we weren't sure if we were going to like the taste of that. But they enjoyed that. They just, even the process of them being able to spread it onto their own food that they'd made and enjoy the taste. So yeah, it was a really good learning experience.
Belinda Elliott, a teacher at the Leongatha Community Preschool in Victoria's South Gippsland region, ending that story from Faith Tavaluyan. Before that, Erin Park brought us the story of Boogara Warrior, who walked out of the Great Sandy Desert in 1967, encountering white people for the first time. I'm David Claughton, and you're listening to A Big Country. Still to come, mangoes are synonymous with summertime in Australia. We'll learn some of the history of how the sweet, juicy fruit came to be a staple of the Australian summer. And the country's longest-running radio program is celebrating 80 years on air this month. Among many long-time loyal listeners to ABC Radio's Country Hour program is an 87-year-old buffalo dairy farmer from southeast Queensland. Margaret Thompson has been listening in for as long as the Country Hour has been sharing rural and regional stories.
We've come into the dairy where the buffalo cows are all being very patient, waiting for their turn to be milked. I don't know if you can hear the chug of the machines behind us powering the suction cups, and I can see the milk going up into the pipes and coming out into this big tank here. How many cows are you milking at the moment?
I've got about 40 on here.
Recapping the top story in this bulletin, temperatures are expected to soar across southeast Queensland today.
Now, as you can hear, the ABC is the soundtrack of this farm that I'm visiting today, And I am here with one of the most devoted Country Hour listeners that there could be. Her name is Margaret Thompson from Mullaney Buffalo. We've got the buffalo having a feed behind us as her son Michael is milking the cows in the dairy. You never like to talk about your age, but you are 87 years young. Margaret, what are your first memories of the Country Hour?
It was always on at lunchtime. Everybody would come in for lunch. Radio would be on and that's it, and you'd listen to it, and then you'd listen to the Lawson. You're out in the country, you didn't have a daily paper, so if you didn't have the Country Hour, you didn't know what else was going on around you. And Queensland's a big place, Australia's even bigger. But my father and mother were always forward thinking, so that they would pick up stuff on the Country Hour. That dam down there is one of the first red soil dams, or dam that's been put into red soil that was successful. They had the courage to do something different, and I guess the next generation aren't much different. I think sometimes it does run in families like that.
Now, you are a person who has a deep love of learning. You're a Churchill Fellow who travelled overseas to learn about buffalo dairies before you and your husband, your late husband, started the dairy on this farm after deregulation, and you got rid of your traditional cows and switched to buffalo.
Traditional dairy, yes. He badly wanted to do something that was different from the opportunity, so you've got to put your heart into it. And when he passed away, we really needed to keep that dream going.
It was Mal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Mal, yeah. So the idea is always more important. You learned about different pasture grasses on the thing. You know, people did things early, and Mal was the same. I don't call them dreamers, I call them visionaries. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And you are still the treasurer after gosh knows how many decades of...
No, I was secretary before.
You were secretary before for the Mary River Catchment Coordinating Committee, which also cares for the land and this magnificent river that we've got that discharges into the ocean, so that everything that happens on the land is very significant for the bottom part of the Great Barrier Reef. How much does land care mean to you?
We were one of the original ones starting off Burrung. Land care has always been important, and then gradually I moved through the ranks of land care, sitting on various committees in Queensland, and actually was on the board of Land Care Australia at one time. So I've had a lot of chances to bring different ideas back.
And what does it feel like to see the result? And I love doing stories about the work that's being done to repair some of the unintentional mistakes of the past with clearing trees along rivers and increasing erosion and that sort of thing.
Sometimes they weren't unintentional. Sometimes they were what we were told was a good idea to do. You were told to de-stag the river and everything else, and so you didn't have any place for the cod to nest.
Yeah. We're talking about the endangered Mary River cod.
Yeah, departments and that have different ideas. Sometimes they're not always proven to be correct. But that's where sometimes the Country Hour comes in very good, because you hear what they're doing in other regions. And believe it or not, I think as a group, we're talking about MCCC now, as a group, with our participants in our projects, they also become part of the family.
And where does your buffalo dairy milk go?
Mullaney cheese, down to what they call cheese time down the Gold Coast. The coast of Sydney generally makes into Indian sweets.
You're also producing buffalo for meat for a whole range of projects, a real nose-to-tail approach.
We try to do everything that way, you know, that you don't waste anything. But we have so many different nationalities now, and buffalo were their prime food. You're always looking for something else.
I find buffalo just to be mesmerising animals. They're so beautiful to look at and remarkably gentle, probably because of the handling that they get here.
Also, you get rid of anything that's not, you don't want to breed from anything that's not.
What do you like about the animals?
I've always liked animals, so that's it. But they're very family oriented, and if you get one that likes you, then they like you, and that seems to go through the family.
What keeps you farming? I mean, lots of other people would have retired.
What am I going to do? A long time ago, when dairy deregulation came in, somebody asked me that, and I said, well, I can't ever imagine not having an animal to pat. It's special. I couldn't go line dancing. I've got nothing like that. And there's a challenge in farming.
Music. They're the taste of summer, and each year Australians eat their way through as much as 75,000 tonnes of the king of fruits. And while most mangoes are grown in the Northern Territory, the fruit owes its taste to the North Queensland town of Bowen, where two popular varieties were created. Some say there was a tree in Sydney's Royal Botanic Garden as early as 1823 that never fruited, and by the 1860s, a tree was growing in Rockhampton. What's not in dispute is mangoes were first commercially produced in Bowen. Queensland DPI Senior Principal Horticulturalist Ian Bally says they arrived from Asia, where mangoes have been eaten for thousands of years.
In the late 1800s, boats coming to and fro from Bowen used to bring mangoes from Southeast Asia. Those boats would be travelling from Bowen, taking horses to India for the remount trade for the British Army. And as they sort of travelled that India to Australia route, they would pick up local fruit at local markets and ports along the way. Quite often those fruit and the seed from those fruit were given to local farmers in the Bowen area. They were often grown on the farm of the harbour master there. And the better ones of those were then passed on again. And Kenston Pride was one of those ones that was passed on to a guy. Harry Lott had a farm at Adelaide Point. I think the farm was named Kensington. And from various selections and over time, the Kensington Pride sort of stood out as being something that was bigger, better and tastier than all the other selections. And it began to be grown around the Bowen area.
The Kensington Pride is still the most popular mango in Australia, and all other varieties developed in Australia have some level of Kensington Pride genetics. Professor Heather Smythe is a flavour expert and the Deputy Director of Research at the University of Queensland's Alliance for Agriculture and Food. She's helped with breeding programs for most major modern Australian mango varieties. She said Kensington Pride's sweet, tangy flavour is unique due to a compound called alpha-terpinolene.
So I've been tasting mangoes for a very long time. That strong terpene-y flavour, which we have come to know as the Australian unique mango flavour that that consumers expect. Mangoes don't taste like that anywhere else in the world. They taste like that terpene-y flavour only here in Australia, and that's because of Kensington Pride or this Bowen style of mango.
100 years after the rise of the Kensington Pride, a second popular mango variety came from Bowen, the R2E2. It's a large, round fruit with firm flesh and a sweet, fresh flavour. The original 40-year-old tree still stands at a research centre in Bowen. Mr. Bally worked on its breeding program. He says research began in the 60s to combat shortcomings with the Kensington Pride.
It was recognised that some of the international overseas varieties were much better producers, especially some of those from Florida that were in the 1940s sort of were selected over there. So this is when it was decided that, yeah, some cross-breeding needed to happen. The introduced varieties' seeds were planted in the ground in Bowen, and as they began to crop, they were assessed for their suitability as commercial varieties for the Bowen area. And one of those trees was a Kent seedling, which became R2E2. It was selected because it was quite large, had a very good flesh-to-seed ratio, and have this great shelf life, much better for travelling than the Kensington Pride.
Today, the Kensington Pride makes up about 40% of mango production, while the R2E2 makes up about 20% and is the number one export variety. Other popular Queensland varieties commercialised in the 2000s include the Calypso and Honeygold. Professor Smythe said they each have their own benefits.
Yeah, Honey Gold's got a beautiful, rich, sweet flavour and all that alpha-terpinolene. It's certainly a premium version of mango. It's a beautiful mango. It's really golden in colour. The Calypso can be absolutely gorgeous when it's looking really good. It is a much, I would say, more delicate flavour compared to the other fruit. I would say a very clean version of that terpene-y, piney flavour that you have from the KP you also get in the Calypso mango.
What's the best way to eat a mango? Under clinical conditions, Professor Smythe tastes mangoes at about 20 degrees to bring out the most flavour.
Just before you want to eat it, put it in the fridge for a couple of hours just to cool it down, but not to cause the chill injury and make it sort of soft and glassy inside. And then cut it with your knife, prepare it, pop those cheeks out. Whether you want to cut off the cubes or whether you want to slice it up and use it in some other way, it's lovely to have cool mango, but just don't keep it in the fridge for long periods of time.
However, as a child in Darwin, Professor Smythe developed her own favourite style.
I was probably about 7 years old and my friend had a swimming pool. In mango season, you could pluck off the tree, climb the tree, plop them into the swimming pool and then just tear the skin off with your teeth and then just tuck into the mango just as it is, no knife, nothing else, and juice all dripping down your chin, dripping down your arms, and then just wash it off in the swimming pool. So it's just the best.
That story from Liam McNally in Mackay in tropical North Queensland. Before that, we heard from a longtime Country Hour listener and buffalo farmer, Margaret Thompson. That's the show for today. I'm David Claughton. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.